For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. We are now on chapter 18 of John Suchet's book, The Last Waltz, and on episode 12 of our radio program, A Book, A Thousand Stories. This chapter is very aptly entitled, An Assassin's Knife Breaks the Emperor's Heart. Print from the French newspaper Le Petit Parisien, dated 25th September 1898, opens the chapter. The newspaper gave an artist's impression of the assassination of Empress Elizabeth in Geneva. Superimposed are a portrait of Lucchini, the assassin, the shores of Lake Geneva, where the Empress was holidaying, and the villa, Villa Achilles in Corfu, where the Empress had declared she wanted her body to be laid to rest. Luigi Lucchini rose to obnoxious notoriety in September 1898, when his slim stiletto knife pierced the Empress's heart and broke that of her husband. This young, displaced émigré born in Paris of Italian parents grew up as an orphan, worked as a labourer and bricklayer, and became an anarchist, joining the extremist regicide squad. We have seen how the precepts of the French Revolution had sparked a wave of change that was to pervade the whole 19th century with anti-monarchist feelings and a desire for democracy and justice for the lower classes. Anarchy was but an expression of all this, and of all people, it was to be Sissi, the unwilling empress, who was to be sacrificed to this anarchical sentiment. The killing was meant to be a great deed from which the monarchies of Europe would not recover. The targeted person was Prince Henri d'Orléans, pretender to the throne of France, who was to visit Geneva in those days. Unknowingly, Empress Sissi, who loved Switzerland, where there were no strict court rules and protocol, and where she could feel normal. Under false name, the Empress had checked in to the Hotel Beau Rivage, together with her friend and lady-in-waiting, Countess Starai. Unfortunately, word spread around about who the smart lady at the hotel was. This proved lethal for the Empress. The assassin waited uselessly for the French crown prince, who at the last minute did not visit Geneva. Suchet tells us that the hotel manager boasted to the newspapers of his distinguished guest. So, to Lucchini's mind, the target of his great deed became the unsuspecting empress of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Elizabeth's fate was decided. Suchet gives us a visual description of the simple, graceful activities that led to the killing. On Saturday, 10th September, the Empress and her friend sat down to an early lunch in the hotel, enjoying first tea and patisserie, and then a three-course lunch which included a half bottle of Medoc. Afterwards, they walked the short distance to the landing stage on the banks of Lake Geneva to take the 1:40 p.m. lake steamer to Montreux. Sissy was dressed entirely in black, wearing a full-length dress with long embroidered sleeves and a high ruffed collar clinched tightly at the waist. We all know how proud she was of her slim figure. She carried a parasol in one hand and a fan in the other. Lucchini waited with his stiletto knife, and as the two ladies approached the landing stage, he swiftly ducked under Sissy's parasol and struck one lethal blow below the victim's left breast. In a quick minute, the assassin was gone, and the Empress was not even aware of what had happened. It seems that she did not even feel pain. So slim was the assassin's tool. The two ladies had already boarded the steamer when Sissy fainted. Her lady-in-waiting then noticed the blood stain on her chest, informed the captain about the identity of her mistress, and as the steamer returned to dock, the Empress's heart gradually came to a halt. She was 60 years old. A photo on page 204 shows her tall, slim, elegant, only a day before her death. Thank you. Back in Vienna at the Hofburg Palace, Franz Josef received a telegram with the news of his wife's murder. He is known to have murmured, "So I am spared nothing in this world." And then, nobody will ever know how much we loved each other. Yes, he had loved Elizabeth. He had loved that young, wild, beautiful girl for whom her Bavaria and her freedom of riding across the countryside was worth much, much more than the stiff protocol of the court. He had loved her, notwithstanding that to him, her character was an enigma. He had loved her and was always concerned about her fragile health. Her death came as a further blow following the assassination of his brother and the suicide of his son, the Crown Prince Rudolf. Lucchini had succeeded in murdering a royal personage, but he had not succeeded in reaching his goal, that of disrupting the organization of the Habsburg Empire, for, notwithstanding, Austria continued to be ruled much in the same old way. It was, however, the end of the 19th century, and inexorably this last decade saw heartache for the old emperor, and similarly, Austria's best-loved musician was experiencing the decline of his career. John Suchet now reveals the weak point in Johann Strauss the Younger's artistic life, his unsuccessful pursuit of success in the composition of opera.
By sheer coincidence, the two greatest opera composers of all time happened to be born in the same year, 1813. Richard Wagner in Germany, in the Saxon city of Leipzig in May, and Giuseppe Verdi in Italy in October, a few kilometers away from Parma. They were born at a time of great upheaval during the latter stages of the Napoleonic Wars. Those calamitous days were to have an effect on both composers and their education. The settlement of Europe as imposed by the Congress of Vienna in 1815 resulted in Verdi, as a native of the Duchy of Parma, becoming an Austrian citizen when that duchy was granted to the estranged Habsburg second wife of Napoleon, namely the ex-Empress Marie-Louise, who at least ruled like a sort of enlightened despot. Wagner's Saxony was no less authoritarian than any of its German neighbours. Both men lived in countries which were then hopelessly fragmented, divided into many different states and subject to the whim and fancy of the great powers of the time, especially Germany, where the rivalry for leadership of the German Confederation between Prussia and Austria was rife. Perhaps the situation was more complex in Italy, with the Pope as a ruler of the Papal States and supranational head of millions of Catholics all over the world and various petty states, either directly or indirectly controlled by Austria, through and her Bourbon allies and relatives. In Italy, there was just one state ruled by a native dynasty, the Kingdom of Sardinia-Piedmont, under the House of Savoy, which until 1848 was as reactionary as the other states. Germany remained rather quiet for a number of years, but not so Italy, where liberal patriotic rebellions broke out in various parts in 1820 and 31, all easily crushed by Austria. Verdi, whether by design or by coincidence, composed certain operas which had an element of Italian patriotism in them, or if not Italian, the fate of others living under tyrants, and which could be seen as a reflection of the situation which the Italians had to put up with. Most of these date to the 1840s. It all began with Nabucco, in which the chorus Va Pensiero, with the patriotic message of the mourning Hebrew slaves, roused suppressed patriotic feelings of audiences all over Italy. It is no mean claim that it became the unofficial national Italian anthem. In I Lombardi alla prima crociata, Verdi glorifies his fellow Lombards' exploits. In La Battaglia di Legnano, the medieval Lombard League defeats the German oppressor Frederick Barbarossa. In Giovanna d'Arco, there is the French national spirit pitted against the English invaders. In Macbeth, Scottish patriots and exiles rant against their tyrannical king and usurper. There are overtones of Italian nationalism in Attila, and in Le Verbe Sicilien, one which finds the Sicilians rising up against their Angevin oppressors. Audiences could easily identify themselves with these events. After a second struggle against Austria, which ended in defeat for Sardinia-Piedmont in 1849, the new king, Vittorio Emanuele II, and his chief minister, Cavour, embarked upon reforms which modernized the kingdom and which promoted itself as the leader in the struggle for independence and unification. Italians living under Habsburg, Bourbon and Papal rule could not openly shout slogans in favor of King Vittorio Emanuele II, so they shouted Viva Verdi wherever there was a performance of his operas, no matter the subject. As an acronym, it stands for Vittorio Emanuele Re d'Italia. Wagner had radical ideas and actually took part in street fighting in Dresden in 1848, when most of Germany rose up in revolt against various despots. With the suppression of the uprising, Wagner had to flee for his life and went into exile in Switzerland. He only returned several years later, when the sentence of death passed on him in his absence was lifted. In Rienzi, he deals with the medieval Roman people's tribute called Rienzo's story. Later Wagner operas all glorify the German national spirit, virtues and heroic acts of characters, real and fictitious. The gods of German mythology in the Ring Cycle and Tannhäuser rub shoulders with medieval heroes like Lohengrin and Parsifal, doomed lovers like Tristan and Isolde, and the real-life master singers of Nuremberg. Besides, events influenced Wagner's treatises and writings about revolution and art. The operas fired the German national spirit and imagination, later most unfortunately hijacked and exploited by the Nazis. And their composition proceeds as well as goes beyond the achieving of German unification under Prussia in 1871.
The 19th century had been the century of opera. Among Strauss's contemporaries were none other than the great Wagner and the great Verdi. Towards the end of the century, a new theatrical form of music was gaining popularity, and this was operetta. Both opera and operetta were theatrical forms of entertainment. Strauss was, yes, the king of waltz. His marches and polkas were universally loved. But by any leap of the imagination, they were not theatre. They were music for the dance halls. Suchet writes that Strauss longed for recognition as a composer of stage works. Proof of this is that in a 31-year period from 1868 to his death in 1900, Strauss composed no fewer than 17 stage works, 16 operettas and one opera. Of these, only one, the operetta The Fledermaus, remained in the repertoire to this day and was a great success. The others barring perhaps One Night in Venice and The Gypsy Baron, were near failures. Frustrated, Strauss kept trying to recreate the success of the Fledermaus till the end of his life. Strauss was encouraged to write an opera by his friend Brahms, but he knew at the offset that Ritter Passmann, a medieval tale from a Hungarian poem, was destined for failure. He wrote, "I cannot but confess that my heroic decision to write an opera not infrequently fills me with despair." Failure at his work inevitably caused him health problems. Ritter Passmann was withdrawn from the court opera just after 9 performances. It was Johann Strauss's first and last attempt at composing an opera. However, he did not give up with operetta, and kept collecting one near failure after the next, becoming more and more angry, bitter, dissatisfied, and lacking in self-esteem. He blamed the librettists, he blamed his ill health, he imagined himself being more ill than in fact he was. He had a very poor opinion about his operetta, Furstein Ninetta, writing, "This is the most miserable libretto ever perpetrated. I write at this piece of work without any inspiration. They can steal it from me. I shall not shed a tear." Furstein Ninetta premiered on the 10th of January, 1893, and was quite a success with the public. The composer himself was surprised, but the press was unkind. The music critic Hans Jorgel wrote, "Sadly, Maestro Strauss has grown old. The dazzling reflector of his rich musical inventiveness is no longer functioning. Everything is thoroughly neat and very tidy, but without inner vitality." In the years that followed, Johann Strauss continued producing music for operetta. In 1893, he began writing music for Yabuka, the Apple Festival, predicting that the work would be ready by the end of the year. But again, as Susha writes, his demons intervened. Having begun the work, he slowed down, complaining of ill health and finding fault with the librettists. Encouraged by his friend Johannes Brahms, Strauss produced a few more operettas, which attained no outstanding success and were still criticized by Hans Jorgel. By then, we are told, Strauss did not attend the premiere, always using his ill health as an excuse for his absence. He did, however, keep in touch with the run of the evening by telephone. Finally, Strauss gave up on operetta, but again he was tempted by a new proposal, composing music for a ballet, on the suggestion of Eduard Hanslick, the music critic known as Vienna's music pope. A competition was organized for librettists to write a text. The winner was one A. Kohlmann from Salzburg, who presented a modern version of Cinderella. Again, Strauss set to work, only to be overtaken by a sense of frustration, and writing to his brother Eduard, "I have my hands full with this ballet. I am writing my fingers to the bone, and I still make no headway. He trudged along with the work and interrupted it to conduct the overture of his one and only successful operetta, The Fledermaus, in May 1899. By this time, due to arthritis, he could no longer play the violin. He was happy to conduct with the baton and kept himself restricted only to the overture of the operetta. It was to be his last appearance at the Vienna Court Opera House. As if somehow he knew it would be the last time, he conducted the overture to the Fledermaus with a vigor and intensity that had never been seen before, to the very last three notes, two swift chords and an end chord. Syncopated, unexpected, and applause and cheers break out. Susha writes, "Is it too much to surmise that the audience rose to its feet, refused to let him straight to the exit, shaking his hands, clapping him on the shoulder as he struggled to leave? Rather than sit back comfortably in an armchair and enjoy the rest of the show, he ordered a carriage to take him back to the Igelgasse and to Adele, his wife." We shall resume the story next week. In the meantime, I thank my collaborators, Gerald Fennec and Albert Storace, for their valued work, as well as Samuel Attard for his technical expertise.